Yeah, I spent some time yesterday after class trying to think about what to do today, because in some sense we finished yesterday what was the reading for the week, and it seemed to me that there were really two possibilities. First, in any case, I'll discuss any questions that have occurred to you since on either the midterm or the readings. But once we've done that, I could either, in effect, go over the chapter as a lecture, and that seems sort of bizarre to me, and yet my impression is a lot of people do learn things better if they hear them, you know, more than once in different forms. But the alternative that occurred to me was to say, all right, if you don't understand the chapter, read it again or ask me questions, and then to simply take a bunch of law and econ-related stuff that's not in the book that I think is interesting and do as much of it as the time permits. Any opinion between those two tactics?
Yeah.
All right. I think it would be more fun for me, and I just don't want to be unfair to you. All right, so let's start with the question. Do any of you have questions? Yes.
Just go over explaining the net neutrality concept again.
I can try, although I'm certainly not an expert in it. In particular, I have not followed what the FCC has said. This was something which I was into when I was reading Larry Lessig's stuff and arguing with him along some years ago. But the basic idea, as I understand it, is that companies that are transmitting internet signals, which would presumably include both people like Comcast, who are sort of the final stage to your house, and also, I guess, the people in between them who are running backbones of things, I guess is what they're called, should not have the option of saying, we will carry types A, B, and C, but we won't let you stream video. We won't let you do other things. And some of the rhetoric is sort of thinking of this as censorship or as they won't let you do things they don't want. I find it a little implausible they would have much interest in doing that. And after all, the real censorship is not, are you watching movies or not, but what do the movies say? And it's awfully costly to listen to everything anybody's doing to see what they say. And so I interpret it much more nearly as the kind of stuff that the incentive to do what's being objected to, it seems to me, has got to be largely one of managing their limited resources. And so the net neutrality view, at least as Lessig was arguing for it, is I am communicating over the internet with you, and the various people in between us should have no say over what we are doing in between that. That they can, and as he refers to it actually as a commons. And I've objected that it isn't literally a commons in the sense that you're still being charged for access. It's more nearly a commodity in the sense that when you buy flour, the grocery store doesn't ask you or you can use it to bake a cake or make bread or make paper mache out of. And from his standpoint, you could say, well, similarly, you're buying bandwidth, you're buying the ability to transmit stuff, and they shouldn't be asking you what you're doing with it. And the counter-argument seemed to me, and again, you know, it's not something I'm heavily involved with, but it seemed to me the obvious counter-argument is it doesn't matter to the grocery store what you do with the flour once you get it off their shelf, but the commodity that the ISP is selling you has got a whole bunch of dimensions having to do with the sort of thing we discussed last time, and different uses of it will impact those in different ways, and therefore it isn't unreasonable for some ISPs to care about that. But that's my understanding, but I have not read the FCC. The FCC has, I guess, come out for net neutrality in some form. It's not something I keep on top of. I'm sure that one or more other people here know more about it in the building, not necessarily in the room. But that's my understanding, at least, of what's going on. All right. Other things, either from the chapter or from anything else we've been doing of late that you'd like to talk about? Yes?
In the book, you talk about charging for information on the Internet.
Yes.
Why that can be costly. I'm wondering if you could elaborate.
Sure. I'm browsing around the internet looking for something, and I come across something which is the first page of a journal article, and which tells me that if I want to read the journal, I either need to have some authorization from some subscribing institution or pay them $10 or whatever it is. And since I don't really know, I mean, typically if I'm browsing the internet, I'm trying to find information on some subject, and I really don't know whether page 7 of this article has anything relevant to me or not. Google gave me something that suggested it might, so it's not very useful to me to have them offer to sell it. Going the other way, as somebody who runs a website, in principle, I could set things up and say, well, you know, you can only download this article of mine if you pay me, but that would be a real pain. Whereas it's much easier for me to do what I in fact do, which is to put up full text of books and articles on the website, and figure that my real benefit from that is some combination of the fact that I write books and articles mostly to spread ideas, not mostly as a source of revenue, and that the more people read my books and articles, the more people will want to pay me money to give speeches, invite me to conferences, maybe even hire me to teach at their university, that kind of side benefit. And if you think about the academic world, as you may or may not know, one essentially is not paid for journal articles. In some fields, you pay for them. In physics, for example, there are page charges. So that if you publish an article in one of the physics journals, I should say my information on this is 30 years out of date, but it's probably still true, that if you published an article in a physics journal, you, which really meant your university normally, had to pay them a certain amount per page to do it. And I don't think law reviews pay at all, but even places that pay tend to pay what's really a token payment from the standpoint of people who they're paying. So in that sense, the standard I like to argue that in a sense, open source software is really a modern version of what's been the standard academic model for a century or more. That the way you do academic work is you publish an article which has your ideas. You make no claim to ownership of those ideas. Other people are free to reuse those ideas. But if you want anybody to take you seriously, the one thing you do have to do is be willing to give them the source code, where the source code is the data for your statistical analysis, whatever the grounds are on which you're arguing that. And did I tell you? Tell this student, this guy, I was talking to someone who was in this class about the stuff on mitochondrial DNA that I was just looking at recently. No, it's an interesting story in terms of in a sense, the power of the internet. I've been reading a book called, I think, The Seven Daughters of Eve, which is a moderately, and you've seen it, or you've read it. Anyway, it's a moderately interesting book about genetic research on human prehistory, really. Largely, though not entirely, involving mitochondrial DNA. And without going into details, one of the neat things about mitochondrial DNA is you get it only from your mother. And the result is that your mitochondrial DNA gives evidence tracing up the maternal line. And also, since unlike ordinary DNA, you're not getting the splitting and recombining, that except for mutation, your mitochondrial DNA is identical to that of your ancestor in the female line 100,000 years ago. And in fact, they've got calculations that the mutation rate is about one mutation every 10,000 years. And that has a really neat result, which is that if we observe that a particular population, everybody has the same mitochondrial DNA plus or minus about five changes. That is evidence. Well, let's take that case actually, because you could be changing in both. We'll make it six changes for a moment. That is evidence that they had a common female ancestor roughly 30,000 years ago. Because 30,000 is enough for each person to have had about three mutations, and if each person had three mutations, they're not going to be the same ones, so that's going to give you six mutations of difference. All right? Makes sense? Anyway, interesting book. I haven't finished it, and I gather that the ending part is sort of more speculative, but the early part. One of the things in the book is an account of a conflict he had with another geneticist, where she had been co-author of an article based on her research, which claimed to find certain results in the population of a particular Pacific island, which, if true, implied that the standard account of how mitochondrial DNA worked was wrong. In fact, that you could get something analogous to the splitting and recombining, although not by the same mechanism, and that therefore all of the work of people like the author of this book was put in doubt because their calculations could be wildly wrong. And the author of the book had a few DNA samples from the same island. So he analyzed them, and they did not fit the pattern that she described in her publication. So he wrote to her, asking her if she could send him samples to support. She never did. All right. That's the point at which one starts wondering. All right. On the other hand, remember, I'm only getting his story, his side of the story. And, you know, when you read it, one of the standard mistakes that we're all inclined to make is you hear one side of a story and you become a partisan. And that's something you shouldn't do. On the other hand, I feel very annoyed if you don't do it. Because when somebody tells you how badly he's been mistreated by his ex-wife or employer or something, if you aren't sympathetic, you're obviously a bad person. But you shouldn't be. Maybe you should pretend to be. You know. All right. So in this case, by his story, the two eventually encounter each other at a conference. And she insists that her results are good. And he says, well, in that case, why did you refuse to send me samples? And she said, well, I didn't refuse to send them. Well, he said, I asked for them, you never sent them. And generally hostile collision. 19 months later, she concedes that her data was wrong. That there had been a mistake in analyzing the samples, and none of it, there's nothing there. This is all his account. All right. So I'm curious. So I go up with Google, and I Google for her name. And I find a review by her of The Seven Daughters of Eve. And it is a hostile review, and it nowhere mentions that she is herself a character in the book. I now know she's a crook. All right. I now know that she is a dishonest person, intellectually dishonest, because she is, whether her review is right or wrong, if you write a hostile review of something where you have a major axe to grind about the particular book you're reviewing, you owe it to the readers to tell them that. And if you don't, people shouldn't trust you. So I thought that was really interesting, because up to that, I have no independent way of telling who's telling the truth, as it were. In fact, I didn't even have her. I still don't have her story on that particular class. She doesn't discuss it in the review. But at this point, I can determine, because of the internet, well, first I can determine because I have the book, the simple fact that her conflict with him was one major story within the book. And because I've seen her review, I can determine that she hides that fact in effect in reviewing it. So I'm therefore able to independently get it. I think that's really neat. I mean, I think sort of the whole business of how we filter out information from the world is one of the sort of critical intellectual skills that you've got to learn. And the internet is really a neat way of doing it. It provides a lot of challenges because, of course, it's an unfiltered medium to start with, so anybody could be lying on it. But this is a particular case where it doesn't matter. I mean, I have enough information to tell. Anyway, that's sort of a digression, but it's relevant to some things. Anyway, let me start with a piece of work I once started doing and never finished, which I think is sort of conceptually interesting. And this has to do with the difference between adversarial and inquisitorial systems for trial. People familiar with those terms? That the standard American system that you're being trained to work in is adversarial in that for both criminal and civil, the theory is that you have one lawyer whose job is to argue for one side and one lawyer to argue for the other. The standard European system, and I think the distinction is usually made sharper than it is, but the sort of the theory of the European system is inquisitorial, which sounds scary to us when we think about the Spanish Inquisition, but what it means is that it's the job of the judge to figure out what happened. So that rather than saying the major work of figuring out the law and the facts is done by the attorneys on the two sides, you say the judge and people working for the judge are supposed to find out what happened and decide what the result is. And on the face of it, that looks as though it ought to be a superior system. Because after all, if you have an adversarial system and the defense attorney comes across some evidence that his client is guilty, he has an incentive not to report that. So you're wasting research, as it were, on each side throwing away half the data, roughly, according to what they find. Each side is biased, has an axe to grind. Wouldn't it be better to have neutral, fair-minded people find out what's happening? It's an argument. But it then occurred to me that there was an interesting sort of economist argument on the other side. And to see that argument, let us imagine that you are a party to a legal dispute. It could be civil or criminal. And you know whether you're innocent or guilty. Now, in civil cases, you don't always know because it may be a legal issue. But suppose you know if you're innocent or guilty. One of the implications is that if you know you're innocent, that is a reason to think that if you randomly collect evidence, it'll tend to be evidence of innocence. If you know you're guilty, that's a reason to think that if you randomly collect evidence, it'll be evidence of guilt. You, as one of the parties, are deciding how much to spend looking for evidence. If you're innocent, you say, well, I should look for as much evidence as I can because every bit of evidence is like almost all of them. Once in a while, there'll be something misleading. It's coming on my side. If you're guilty, you may well say, well, wait a minute. It doesn't do any good to look for evidence because, you know, I could be very lucky and get some misleading evidence that shows that I'm innocent, but mostly it's not going to do me much good. So the argument then is that, like some other interesting things. The adversarial system is a way of giving people an incentive to reveal their private information. That the person who knows he's innocent will spend more resources on gathering information, making him more likely to get acquitted. The person who knows he's guilty will spend fewer resources, making him more likely to get convicted. And you thus have a sort of self-interested mechanism for making people reveal information. And I should say, it's in general an interesting subject in economics, what people think of as sort of signaling theory, which is, how do you set things up so that people acting in their rational interests act in a way that conveys their private information to other people to whom it's valuable. All right. Did I discuss at some point in this class the idea of property taxes based on self-revealing information? Oh. This is sort of a clever idea that somebody, not me, came up with a long time ago, which, among other things, provides an alternative to eminent domain. And the argument is, you have property taxes, and it's self-assessed property taxes, that anybody who owns property simply says what the property is worth and is taxed on that rate. And the only trick to it is that he is then legally obliged to sell at that price to any buyer. So the argument is that I have no incentive to state a value above the value to me, because after all, the higher the value of the state, the higher the taxes I'll pay. I might take the chance of stating something a bit below my value in order to hold all the taxes, especially if I don't think anybody else is going to want it. But I'm going to have to be cautious about that. So if you're imagining the problem of how do you assemble parcels of land for a highway or for a shopping mall or something, a system where everybody has revealed the value of his land and is obligated to sell at that price makes it a whole lot easier to do that, and you now don't need eminent domain. So that's sort of it. It's a neat and clever idea. Some people are offended by it because they say, well, if this is the house I've lived in all my life and it would be just dreadful to me to have to lose it, why should I have to pay very high taxes as a result? And sort of, I guess, one possible reply is, well, you are obviously very rich. You're very rich in an odd kind of way, but you have a house of great value to you. Why isn't that as good a reason to be taxed as any other? But in any case, but that's an example of institutions designed to make people, in effect, reveal their private information accurately. And there are obviously other examples. I suppose perhaps one of the most famous such things, which hopefully you've all encountered, is I cut, you choose. All right. The technical term in economics for such things is incentive compatible. There are rules in which it is in your self-interest to do what the rule wants you to do, and I cut, you choose. It's in my self-interest to cut evenly because I know you're going to take the bigger piece. And you can think of a variety of other more complicated things. There's a rather clever scheme that somebody came up with for, in a democracy, getting people to give a true account of how much things are worth to them. If you imagine the problem, one of the many problems with democracy as a way of making decisions is that it's enormously important to me that a certain law be passed. It's slightly important to you that it not be passed. I cast one vote for it. You cast one vote against it. So you'd like some system where we could somehow reveal intensity of preference. And the problem is, if you just ask me how important it is, well, if I care for it at all, I'll say, you know, $1 million. And the scheme is one in which the rule is that I can say any amount I like. You then add up the amounts positive and the amounts negative, and the one that's the larger number wins, just like Marshall would want us to. But if your vote made the difference between winning and losing, all right, if it won by $100,000 and you voted $300,000, you owe a tax equal to the amount of your vote necessary to flip the result. And if you work out the logic of it, it turns out that as long as people don't cooperate, as long as everybody acts individually, it's never in your interest to lie. Because if I exaggerate how much it's worth to me, and that has any effect, that is, if that flips it over, I'm then ending up paying more in taxes than the benefit to me of what I'm getting. So that's sort of another interesting example of an incentive-compatible system. And one way of thinking of sort of the whole law and econ efficiency project is, how do you make the legal system incentive-compatible? How do you set it up? Yeah.
If you figure there's like a 1 in 1,000 chance you're going to be the person who receives the penalty.
Well, it's not just one person. Every single person whose amount eliminated, given what everybody else does, flips it, pays it.
Okay.
Right? If it went, if it won by 100,000,
yeah.
And anybody who, if his vote removed, who voted more than 100,000 is going to pay, he's going to be paying a penalty. Because each of them taking everybody else's given changed the outcome. But anyway, but that's, but it's another interesting scheme. The problem with it is it doesn't work if people cooperate. Because both of us say 100 million. And now that's enough so that it goes, so that it flips by more than 100 million, so neither of us has made the difference and so forth. So it's like if we get into Nash equilibrium at some, if you think about Nash equilibrium, that's got the same, it's got the same kind of logical structure. But anyway, so I was just talking about the adversarial versus inquisitorial as an interesting case of trying to think about institutions from an economic standpoint as a way of... Now, it's by no means a rigorous argument, because if you really think about it, you could imagine the case where the innocent guy says, if I spend $100, I'm going to get enough evidence of innocence, so I'm probably acquitted. And the guilty guy says, $100 is never going to give me any evidence that I'm innocent. But $10,000, and then throw away all the evidence that goes the wrong way, maybe I'll get something. So it's sort of an elasticity kind of argument, which I'm not going to go into. But it does suggest a possible advantage to the adversarial system. Now, the other advantage of the adversarial system, which I'm not really going into there, is the possibility the inquisitorial system might be rigged. That the adversarial system has the advantage that there is somebody on your side, and there, as opposed to the possibility that there's one judge who looks at you and says, "I've got a guilty face. I'm not going to believe anything on the other side." That brings me to another issue, and this is one I published on, and that's the question of how we select defense attorneys for indigent felony defendants. All right. In theory, we have an adversarial system. In a sizable majority of all U.S. felony cases, both lawyers are working for the same side. What I mean by that is that the state-appointed, state-paid and state-appointed lawyer for an indigent felony defendant is an employee of the state, and the state is the party who is litigating against the defendant, state of California versus Jones or whatever. And that seems like a rather disturbing situation, because although you would like to believe that the lawyer is an honest guy who'll do his best, and some of them surely are, on the other hand, it's clear that the state has a bunch of interests, not just convicting, but not spending too long on the trial and such. And if the appointed defense attorney wants to be an appointed defense attorney, there's much to be said for pleading guilty in order to save the judge time and trouble and then getting appointed again and so forth. And that's the potential problem. And I started thinking about this many, many years ago when I was a faculty fellow at University of Chicago Law School. One of my colleagues, Steve Schulhofer, came to me and he said, "I have an idea. And it's an idea that might interest you." And the idea was using a voucher system for indigent criminal defense to say, all right, the usual complaint about the system is the amount of money available for defense for indigent defendants is too low, and that may well be true. Certainly in many states it's very small. Put that aside, you can have the same amount of money and just say the defendant is the one who gets to choose the attorney, who gets to choose who gets the money. And that was Steve's idea. And part of what was fun about the project was that Steve was regarded as one of the left-wing members of the U of C law school faculty, and insofar as libertarians count as right-wing, I was on a far right wing of that faculty, and here we were collaborating in an article which ended up getting published, and it's recently a popular version has gotten, somebody asked us basically if we would rewrite it as a more popular article, and we did that, and that's been published too. And there was some discussion at the school as to which of us was subverting which one. And I claimed that that question was unambiguously answered when Steve and I gave a law and econ workshop on the paper, and I had the pleasure of hearing Steve Schulhofer preach to Judge Posner on the virtues of the free market. But anyway, it was fun. But the point, it seems to me, is an interesting one, and a fairly important one, because that basically, it seems to me that a lot of our criminal procedure for indigent defendants is fake. That is to say that on paper, it's just like for everybody else, but that in practice, what it really is often, not always, somebody who has been selected by the state to make the process go smoothly, and of course they would prefer not to convict you if you're innocent, but they would also prefer not to spend a lot of time making sure whether you're innocent or guilty, and therefore, you have a problem. So that sort of is another, to me, interesting issue, which, as I say, we got into in that article. Another thing I thought I would mention, we didn't lend you any of these things, but this is something that people may have heard of and that people often get wrong, is a fairly famous case, namely Furman v. Georgia. Furman v. Georgia is the case that found that Georgia's application of the death penalty was unconstitutionally, how to put it, I don't think the actual court actually said it was unconstitutionally biased racially, although that was a good deal of the argument, but that it was random, essentially. There was no good basis for who got the death penalty. And the standard version of the case that many people sort of vaguely remember is that the statistical analysis of all of the death penalty cases in Georgia over some period of time showed that black defendants were more likely to get death penalty than white defendants. In fact, it showed the opposite. It was more interesting than that. What it actually showed was that on average, black defendants were less likely to get the death penalty. But the reason for that, if you did analyze statistics, was that black defendants killed black victims. That most murder is intra-racial, and that if you did your a regression, a statistical procedure to see what determined whether you got a death penalty, it turned out that being black, if you held race of victim constant, a black murderer was more likely to get the death penalty than a white murderer. But if you held race of murderer constant, someone who murdered a black victim was much less likely to get executed than somebody who murdered a white victim. That the first effect was fairly small. That is, the prejudice against black defendants was, I don't know, 10%. I'm making up the numbers, but it wasn't a huge difference. Big prejudice in favor of people who kill blacks over people who kill whites. Well, since most of the black murderers killed black victims, the result was that the increased chance of being executed because you were a black murderer was more than outweighed by the decreased chance of being executed because you had killed a black victim. And thus, if you just looked at the raw numbers, the system appeared to be discriminating in favor of blacks rather than against, in favor of black murderers rather than against. Which is sort of a nice example of why statistics is actually useful, because the raw numbers, you know, seem to tell the opposite story. It seemed to me that what the court should have said, and not being a constitutional scholar, I have no idea if it's arguable or not, was that the reason it was unconstitutional was it was not providing equal protection to people who might be murdered. That is to say that implicitly they were providing, if you believe the death penalty is good for anything, if it deters, they were providing more protection to their white citizens than their black citizens, and that arguably violates equal protection. In principle, you would think, what, you need someone black who has been murdered to sue?
Yeah, like it would be hard to find someone.
Maybe the relatives of somebody black who had been murdered, or somebody, a class action for all blacks in fear of death due to the fact that, I don't know if you did it. I'm not a lawyer.
Yeah.
I mean, I was interested sort of in the logic of the situation. It just struck me as an interesting case, which at least, I'm sure people who are really seriously involved know the facts. I did a little Googling, and you can certainly find a discussion of what the real statistics showed in those. But a lot of people don't. And it's sort of, to me at least, a rather intriguing and interesting result. All right, let me now go on to a set of questions which I'm interested in because they're relevant to the book that I'm supposed to be writing at the moment. And that's a book based on my Legal Systems Very Different seminar. And one of the things I want to be able to do for that book is to find a whole bunch of, as it were, issues or threads that run through almost all legal systems. So I want to say, all right, here is a problem our legal system must deal with. This is also a problem that had to be dealt with by the legal system of ancient Athens, the legal system of the Jews 2,000 years ago, the legal system of Saga period Iceland. Almost any legal system has to deal with this. How are the different ways the different ones did it? Here is another such thing. How are the different ones? And I have some sort of tentative candidates, and I thought it would be fun to run through them, discuss a little bit what we know of how different legal systems, including ours, deal with them, maybe see if you could think of other examples of sort of broad issues that legal systems have to deal with. And let me start with what I think is my best case, my most interesting case, and that's the problem of the incentive to prosecute. That in order for a legal system to work, there's got to be some reason why when you break the law, something happens to you. So that means there's got to be somebody who has some reason, whatever the mechanism is, to take whatever action is relevant in that legal system to, in effect, get you convicted and punished. I'm saying in effect because you can imagine, using legal systems broadly, there are some legal systems where there's never any trial. If you think of a system of norms, what happens is other people decide you're a bad person and don't want to associate with you, and that's the punishment. And so that's one category, as it were, of legal systems. So, but all of these systems, in order for it to work, there's got to be some reason why when you do the thing the system is supposed to stop, someone does something that stops you or that makes it undesirable to do that. And you can start out with the question of who takes those actions. And roughly speaking, I think there are three categories you observe in different legal systems. The one we're most used to is the professional prosecutor, a policeman, a government employee. The other one that we're used to is the victim. That's how our tort system works. It's the victim who basically has the burden of calling the existence of the tort to the attention of the court and proving that guilt and all the rest of it. Victim or his employee, the lawyer. And the third possibility is anybody. So if you think about reputational enforcement in a system of norms, anybody can report, you know, that guy is a scumbag. Why he? Let me tell you what he did to his wife, or how he cheated somebody. And in fact, I've just been observing such a mechanism. One of my hobbies is the Society for Creative Anachronism, which is a group which does medieval and Renaissance historical recreation. And sometime in the last week or so, on one of the SCA email lists, there is a posting saying, so-and-so, named person who I knew, is not to be trusted. He cheats people. That wasn't the quote, but essentially that. And this being the days of the internet, it included a link to a thread about problems people had with this person. This is somebody who, among other things, did small-scale publishing of books having to do with the medieval hobby, essentially. And the claim was that authors reported that he had never paid the royalties that he owed them for the books, that other people reported in various other ways as simply being cheated by him. And as it happened, one of the authors who was mentioned in the thread is somebody who I've known for 30 years or so. And so I emailed him and said, you know, is this story true? And his answer is basically, my part of the story is true, and I suspect the rest of it is true. So that was a case where the norm enforcement was not being done by a trial. And yet, that is a legal system in a broad sense. That's a way in which bad behavior results in bad things happening to you and therefore reduces bad behavior. Right. So that would be one example. But there are other anyone systems. So that I think the term is private attorney general in U.S. law. Is that right? That there are certain offenses for which specified that basically a private individual can prosecute on behalf of the state. I think that's a correct statement. In Athenian law, which I know more about than that particular feature of American law, basically their equivalent of tort cases were cases where only the victim could take it to law, and their equivalent of criminal cases were cases where any male, adult, Athenian citizen could take it to law. In 18th century English criminal law, which we will be getting to in a month or two, because that's in one of the chapters near the end of the book, you had on paper the same distinction between criminal law and civil law that we have. A criminal case was Rex v. Smith, the king versus Smith, but the king didn't have any lawyers, at least for ordinary criminal cases. So that in fact, what was happening in English criminal law in the 18th century was that legally speaking, any Englishman could prosecute any crime. And in practice, it was again the victim or people working for the victim who normally prosecuted a crime. So that's one set of, if you just think of the problem of how do you get law enforced, that's one area. You've got a bunch of different mechanisms. Some societies like ours use more than one of the mechanisms. We've got the different criminal and tort. And of course, we have norms in our society too, even though we don't usually think of them as law. Yeah?
Or if you look at systems where, the question is how do you as prosecute or enforce laws? You know, it's kind of the tech question, I think, goes along with it. What happens when you have a system set up where they prosecute too much? Or
yes, that's the next step.
Okay.
You're just one step ahead of me in my discussion. Absolutely. So the first question is, what's the mechanism? And the second question is the enforcement to prosecute, the incentive to prosecute. And that, as you are indicating, although people don't often realize it, is a double-edged problem. that you have to have enough incentive so that serious offenses get prosecuted, but incentive means somebody benefits by doing it, and if someone benefits by doing it, he may do it even when you haven't actually violated anything. And my favorite, my sort of poster child for institutions specifically designed to deal with this problem is classical Athens. Because in Athenian law, the incentive to prosecute was that most crimes were punished with a fine, quite large fines. And the prosecutor got a sizable chunk, like, I don't know, a third or 40% or something of the fine. And that's obviously an invitation to look for somebody rich and unpopular and accuse him of something. All right? There were two solutions in Athenian law. One of them was that up to three people a year could be prosecuted for the crime of malicious prosecution. They didn't call it that. They had their own term. But the other one, which was much more elegant, was they had big juries, several hundred people on a jury. And if you did not get a certain percentage of the jurors to vote for conviction, I think it was like 30%, the prosecutor was fined. So you could imagine that system in our court system, right? You could imagine, all right, you got a jury of 12 good men and true. If you can't prove at least four of them that the tortfeasor is guilty, you have committed an offense and we are going to charge you a fine for you, the plaintiff, for doing it. But that sort of is, it's a neat example. In general, Athenian law feels to me, there's one part of Athenian law which I like to claim looks as though it was invented by a mad economist. And the general feeling of Athenian law is a bunch of really smart people, but they're really smart intellectuals. So their ideas aren't all good ideas, but they're clever ideas. And that what I gave was just sort of one description. But I'll give you another clever idea, which actually is related to the same issue. It's a different approach to false accusations. And that is that if you've stolen something from me, and I can prove it, I not only get the something back, I get maybe twice its value, remember, but some additional penalty. And this raises an obvious problem. Because in order for me to be able to prove you've stolen something from me, one obvious way is to search your house to see if the thing that's identifiable in my possession is in it. You know this story already? How do we... What is the obvious danger if we say that if I can get legal permission to seek your house, to search your house, and if I find something of mine in it, then I get it back and you owe me damages? What's the obvious problem with that? What? Yeah, of course. And if you were a clever Athenian, how would you make sure that people searching houses couldn't plant stuff in them? This is Athens, not America. They have rather different norms in Athens. Anybody have a guess? You got it. Precisely so. I can search your house, but I've got to go in stark naked. Isn't it great? Anyway, that's the sort of thing that's fun, looking at these legal systems. But in any case, but it's, again, it's the same issue, really. It's the incentive to prosecute and worrying about the high end of it. You have to worry about the low end of it as well, but you have to worry about the high end of it. And in fact, as we'll be discussing when we talk about 18th century England, one of the real puzzles in the 18th century English criminal case, one of the puzzles, I've got an article on this which got me into it, partly, is why did anybody prosecute criminals? Because if you prosecute a tortfeasor, you get damages. If you prosecute a criminal and you convict him, they hang him. Or maybe they transport him to the New World, or maybe they say, we'll let you off if you'll join the Navy. We need sailors this year because they're having a war. But the one thing that the court doesn't do is to say, all right, he owes you money for doing this. You might get to reclaim your property, I suppose, but that's all. And so the puzzle is, what was the incentive? And we'll get to that when we get to talk about English criminal law, but I believe I know what the incentives were that caused people to prosecute in that system. But they worried about it too. And in fact, as we'll see again when we get to that, you get the other side too. Because there's a point in the middle of the 18th century when, because they're worried about incentives, they set up large rewards for convicting people of certain crimes, and they then start getting bogus convictions and getting scandals of bogus convictions. Casanova, I don't know if any of you ever read Casanova's memoirs, but if you like history, he was a real guy. He was an 18th century intellectual, con man, gambler, entrepreneur, sort of a mix of stuff. An adventurer is the term that was used contemporarily, the term he uses for other people. And he spent some time in England, in London, at one point in his life. And he mentions that there was a sign, whose words I've now forgotten, that he saw in a number of windows. And so he asked one of his English friends what it actually meant. And he said, well, that actually means is perjured testimony for sale here. That this was whatever the way was of offering that particular service. So what did I say? So that's one. Yeah.
I'm wondering if you've looked more recently. I read a lot of stuff recently about U.S. attorneys, especially large scale white collar crime, and how they can kind of go after mid scale people and really burn them over the coals to get the large people.
Yes.
And even if they do stuff that's considered misconduct, by the time that sort of process works, they're already out of that doing white collar.
Yep. Yes. That's, in a sense, it's related to a problem which I will be discussing later in when we're talking about criminal law. And, well, the argument I make there is that on the face of it, you would like to have efficient punishments. You'd like to have punishments such as fines, where the loss to the criminal is a gain to somebody else, rather than a punishment like execution, where the loss to the criminal gives nobody else anything, or a punishment like imprisonment, where not only does it cost the prisoner something, it costs the rest of the people living as well. One trouble with efficient punishments, though, is exactly the point you've just been raising, that if if when I convict you, you pay a $100,000 fine, that gives me an incentive to convict you whether or not you're innocent. And we say, well, we solve that problem by saying, well, we won't have efficient punishments, that the punishment is going to be jail or something like it. Unfortunately, you can convert inefficient punishments into efficient punishments by out-of-court settlements. So if I have the ability to put you in jail for 5 years and you're a rich white-collar I forget who the guy was who was accused of various things quite a while back, we could have a settlement where you agree to pay $10 million in compensation for the evil you've done, and I won't put you in jail. I just converted an inefficient financial to efficient. Another more common version of that is that what you pay me off with is testimony, not necessarily truthful testimony. So that now I say, look, I can get you in jail for a year, but if you happen to have the following information, we'll be nice to you. And I know somebody who I've known online for a long time, I've met once or twice in the real world, who when he was, 20 or so, by his account, which I believe is truthful, a roommate who he didn't really know, was just sharing the apartment with, stole some property. Someone found it. The roommate testified that he was the one who had done it. He ends up charged with theft he had not committed. And according to him, it was made reasonably clear to him, I think by his court-appointed attorney, he was at one point shared a jail cell with somebody who was accused of a very high-profile crime, the murder of, San Francisco politician, if I remember correctly. I think that's right, but I might have the details wrong. And it was suggested to him that if by any chance his jailmate had confessed to him committing the crime, then they would look very nicely on his own. He, of course, refused to do that and ended up spending 6 months or 9 months in jail. By his account, when he got out of jail, he was hired by the firm which he was convicted of having stolen from. They presumably didn't believe he was guilty. but anyway, he's an interesting guy, and that will be a long story, but this has sort of affected his life ever since, because he's become an extreme skeptic, somebody who basically is very reluctant to believe the official account of anything at all unless he can verify it himself.
Have you seen any ways other systems have dealt with, I guess publicity, because at some point there's incentive for the prosecutor to go after the big name, whether or not there's actually something that's wrong going on, that bad, and there's a lot of research.
It's an interesting question, but not one I've thought about. But anyway, so let me just sort of say that one of my clearest example, I think, of a thread that runs through all of these is the ease incentive to prosecute, the mechanism, and in particular, the double problem of having enough and not too much incentive to prosecute. Second issue, which runs through, I think, pretty much all systems, is what I think of as filling in the blanks. That a legal code never has enough information to answer all questions. So how, when somebody does something which maybe you're pretty sure is wrong, is illegal, but it doesn't actually fit any of the specific things, how do you deal with it? And one interesting case for this is Chinese law. This is imperial Chinese law. Chinese law through most of the 19th century and for 2,000 years almost before that. And it's an interesting case because the pattern of Chinese law, from what we can see, is that it was designed to be, as it were, an algorithm for every offense specified the penalty. And if you look at the equivalent of cases that we've got from Imperial Chinese law, a lot of the argument is not whether anybody's innocent or not. That they almost always take it for granted that the guy they're dealing with is guilty. But what is the legal status, and in particular, what crime has he committed, and therefore should he be exiled for 2 years or three? Should he receive 20 strokes of a bamboo rod or 40? That kind of issue. And part of the problem they handle by analogy. They say doing X is a crime which has the following punishment. The Y that he did is really just about like X but a little worse. So we ought to get the same punishment one step up. Or a little bit better, so we ought to get the same punishment one step down. And that covers a bunch of stuff. But then there are other things that aren't covered, and it turns out that there are two sort of blank check solutions to this one. One of them is that he is convicted of doing that which ought not to be done. And then presumably the court gets to decide what happens to him. And one of them is that he is convicted of having violated an imperial decree, which does not actually require that the imperial decree exists. He may have violated a decree that the emperor would have made if he had been aware of this problem, but actually hasn't made. So those are ways in which they are in effect saying, and if there's nothing in print that says what you've done wrong, we have ways of taking care of it. And I should say the Imperial Chinese is a very interesting case in a bunch of other ways, so I think I'm not going to go into today, but may get into next time. I need to fill up some time with something interesting, which is, I think, a useful thing to do. But there are a variety of others. The Athenian law actually had a court for crimes there is no law against. And presumably you were tried by a jury, which got to decide what the proper penalty was for something you've done that obviously was wrong, but that there was nothing against. The Jewish law, which is, I've concluded, the best documented legal system in the history of the world, which I don't know nearly enough about, but I know a fair amount about. And there are a number of ways in which they dealt with the problem. One of them was by the doctrine of offense around the Torah, where the theory was the Jewish biblical law says you can't do X. Well, how about doing things that are getting close to X? Well, the rabbis will decide that's a violation of his law too, because they've got to keep you far enough away from violating as a chance. So that, for example, as you probably know, the kosher laws forbid your eating milk and meat at the same meal. And indeed, if you're reasonably orthodox, they forbid you eating milk and meat off the same plates at different times. So orthodox Jews have to have two sets of plates, more than two, maybe at least two for that. And they forbid your eating them within a certain length of time with each other. As I understand it, the sole biblical basis for this prohibition is the prohibition of boiling a kid in his mother's milk. But you have to put a fence around that, and a fence around that, and a fence around that, and by the time you're done, you've got these rules which have been around for a couple of thousand years about milk-lick and flesh-lick, about meat and milk. Islamic is an interesting case. That people think of Sharia, of Islamic law, first they think of Islamic law as being Sharia, and second they think of Sharia as being based on the Quran. The trouble is that the Quran, unlike the Old Testament, has very little law in it. All right, the Old Testament actually has a lot of law, which turns out to be another problem for Jewish law, which we'll get to in a little bit. But the Quran doesn't have very much. And mostly Sharia is based on what are called hadith, which are traditions of things that the Prophet and his companions did and said. When I say it's based on it, I mean that within Islamic legal theory, that's the base. There is a scholarly dispute as to whether that's really where any of it came from. And that it's generally recognized that there are many, many traditions that aren't true. And there was a big project, like, I don't know, 800 or 1,000 years ago, of scholars to try to weed out the traditions they were pretty sure were real and throw away the ones that might be bogus. But that still left them with, I suppose, some thousands of official ones, and some modern scholars think they're all bogus, too, that the law really came out of other sources. But at least the theory is that if we know what Muhammad, who was inspired by God and those around him, did, that will tell us what we ought to do. As well as the Quran, where the Quran says. And furthermore, there was a very extensive scholarly project ending in about the 10th century or so to deduce from those materials the general rules of law. and something else I'll get to in a few minutes, there developed four different schools of law following the teachings of basically four different legal scholars in the over a period of a couple hundred years after the death of the prophet, which had different, not wildly different, but different interpretations of just what the implications were of the hadith in the Quran. But that still leaves a whole lot of stuff missing. There's a whole lot that isn't covered by Sharia. And real Islamic societies, in addition to Sharia, have a variety of other sets of law coming from other sources. That there's one set of law which basically looks like it is Bedouin blood feud law as modified by Muhammad in order to make it, as it were, less of a problem. I'm not sure that's what it is, but that's what it looks like. There's another chunk which is administrative regulations. I should say, one of the central theories of Islamic law, of Sharia, is the separation of law and state. All right? We talk about the separation of state and church. What they talk about is the idea the state doesn't make the law. The law comes from religious sources. It is deduced by legal scholars. Sometimes I like to say that Sharia is what American law would be if law professors ran the world. Because the equivalent of law review articles, rather than a Supreme Court decisions, determine what the law is. The equivalent of law review, these are old law review articles. These are law review articles, most of them from before about 1000 AD. But these are the works on legal scholarship of the great early legal scholars saying what the law implies. But in practice, the state has the actual job of appointing judges and enforcing law and such. It needs administrative regulations to do that. And the result is that large chunks of the law in real, even traditional Islamic societies, when I mean talking about modernized ones like Turkey, large chunks of the law are made by the state, even though in theory they're not supposed to be. So all of those are ways in which blanks are filled in a variety of different societies. And if you think about our society, how do we fill in the blanks? We fill in a lot of the blanks by court interpretation. Right? That's how the common law system is working. And because we have a precedent system, which Sharia does not, once courts have ruled, that at least tentatively gives you an answer for the next case. All right, another area which I find is interesting, and which I think applies not to all, but to many different legal systems, is what I think of the problem of working around fixed points. And I think I started thinking about that in the Jewish law context, but it applies to many others. And what I mean is you have a legal system which purports to be based on divine revelation. All right? God told Moses, here is the Pentateuch, here are the first five books. You are not to add, it says explicitly, you are not to add anything to the law that is in these books, and you are not to take away anything from the law that is in these books. All right, well now let us suppose that you are a legal scholar in Judaism some point in the last 2400 years or so, and you don't like what's in the book. You say it's obviously absurd that if a kid gives lip to his parents, he should be stoned to death, and yet that's what the Old Testament says is supposed to happen. There's this real problem with how you run a credit system, how you have loans in a system where every seventh year all loans are canceled. All right? These are two examples out of many where the Jewish legal, the halakhic authorities, as they call them, the Jewish legal scholars faced this problem that God told them the answer and it was wrong. And then there are the additional problems which are sort of more nearly hole filling where God didn't tell you the answer, we got this legal problem, what do we do? And the Jewish system found what seems to me, they found a bunch of different solutions, actually. But let me start with my favorite one. And that is the doctrine of the oral Torah. The written Torah is the Pentateuch. That's the actual first five books of the Old Testament. The oral Torah, however, is what God told Moses on Mount Sinai that Moses didn't write down. And Moses passed that on in oral tradition to the present-day legal scholars, I'm speaking as of 100 B.C. or 150 B.C. or so. And the result is that the present-day legal scholars can explain how to interpret the written Torah. And while there may be cases where their interpretation seems bizarrely out of sync with the words of the written Torah, that's all right. We've got God's word telling us how to interpret the Torah. So the oral Torah provides one sort of neat excuse if you believe, say you believe or maybe actually believe in the divine revelation for how you can get around it. Now, one particular bit of this is that there's something in the written Torah which says something along the lines of, if you have a hard case and don't know what to do, abide by the views of the majority. And this gets interpreted by the halakhic scholars to mean that if there is a dispute about what the law is, a majority vote of the halakhic scholars determines it. And this exists in a formal fashion in terms of the Sanhedrin in the early period, when you actually have sort of an equivalent of a, not exactly Supreme Court, but Supreme Court-like thing with a specified number of members. Becomes less clear after the diaspora, when it's really not clear quite who counts. And this provides a solution. See, there's another problem in having a divinely inspired legal system. I'm going to argue, by the way, that it's not just the Jews have this problem, that Americans have this problem, too. That if you think about our attitude to the Constitution, we treat it the same way. We don't literally say it's divinely inspired, but it's a fixed point. A Supreme Court justice is not supposed to say, the reason I am upholding the law is that, yes, it's inconsistent with the Constitution, but the Constitution was wrong. That may be what he does, but it's not what he's allowed to say. All right? Any more than a rabbi is allowed to say God was wrong. One of the problems with the divinely inspired system is that truth is not determined by majority vote. So let us suppose we have two judges in ancient Israel. They are both scholars. Each of them has reached his own opinion about what the Torah and the oral Torah imply. And they're different. And they're judges. Do we really want a legal system where you will predictably get different outcomes according to which judge judges your case? That's not very satisfactory. And so the position that the early legal scholars took was truth is not determined by majority vote, law is. So that the result, the position was eventually established that if you were a legal scholar who disagreed with the majority, you were entitled to argue till you were blue in the face. It was not a crime to argue that they were wrong. But it was a crime to judge according to your interpretation instead of their interpretation. And this actually gets me to one of my favorite stories, and that is in the period, I think this would be about the 1st century BC roughly, but I'm not sure exactly, you have for quite a long time two different schools of law called the school of Hillel and the school of Shammai, which differed in their interpretation of law. And for a period of about four generations, they were mutually tolerant. That is to say, that although they disagreed about the details, for example, of when food was ritually clean or unclean or things of that sort, nonetheless, they would eat at each other's tables, marry each other's daughters, and so forth. That they took the position, essentially, this is honest disagreement. Eventually, that broke down for reasons that are not entirely clear. And the story that's associated with the breakdown is the story of the furnace of Achnai. And this involves a legal scholar called Eleazar ben Hyrcanus, who I gather from the story was thought of as sort of one of, if not the leading scholar, and who was, I think, the leading person in the school of Shammai, which was the minority school at the time. And a bunch of people who are referred to in the story, this is a Talmudic story, as the sages, who pretty clearly are school of Hillel people, and of whom at least one of their leaders was himself a disciple of Eleazar initially. And the argument is over the furnace of Achnai. And what the issue is that if an object is made impure, for example, if it's touched by a corpse, you can purify a clay object by breaking it up. So somebody has a furnace or oven which has been made impure of clay. He breaks it up. He then reassembles it with sand between the pieces and plaster over it to hold the whole thing together. Is it now clean or unclean? And Eleazar took the position that the law says that if you break it up, it's now clean, so it's clean. And the sages take the position, this is obviously a fake, and he's put it back together again, and isn't really broken, therefore it's unclean. And the story goes that Eleazar argues with the sages, and he gives every possible argument to show why his position is correct, and they are unconvinced. And finally, Eleazar says, if I am correct, let this carob tree testify that I am correct. And the carob tree uproots itself and flings itself 100 yards downwind. And Rabbi Rabbi Joshua, I think it is, replies, a carob tree has nothing to contribute to the disputes of sages. And they keep going, and Eleazar offers more and more arguments than the sages. I'm going to say, Eleazar, if I am right, let this stream testify that I am right. And the stream turns around and starts flowing the other direction. And Joshua says, a stream has nothing to contribute to the disputes of sages. And it keeps going and going and going. And finally, Eleazar, if I am right, let the walls of this lecture hall we are disputing in testify that I am right. And the walls begin to lean inwards. And Rabbi, I think it's Joshua, it might be Akiva, one of the sages turns to the walls and says, it is not for you to interfere in the disputes of sages. And the walls, out of respect for him, stop moving. And out of respect for Eleazar, don't go back upright. And they keep going. And finally, Eleazar says, if I am right, let heaven testify that I am right. And a voice comes out of heaven saying, in all matters of halacha, in all matters of the law, Rabbi Eleazar is correct. And Rabbi, I think Joshua, looks up at heaven and he says, it is not in heaven. But out. He doesn't say but out, that's my interpretation. But the implication of that, which is the interesting part, is the job of interpreting the law is no longer God's job. It's our job now. You gave us the job on Mount Sinai, you don't get to take it back. And if you think about it from a sort of a less religious standpoint, it makes a lot of sense to say we don't want miracle workers or apparent miracle workers to be able to say we're speaking with God's voice and therefore you've got to obey us. All right? So it's not an absurd position, even though it seems sort of weird to say to God, you know, our interpretation of what your law is superior to yours. And there's a number of additional pieces of the story, one of which involves a prophet up in heaven, who I guess people see in their dreams, if I've got it right, and someone asks him, what was God doing during this dispute? And he says, oh, he was laughing and crying and saying, my children, they defeat me. So it's sort of a neat story. But it goes on, because there's then a much darker continuation of the story, in which the sages vote to ban, to excommunicate, in effect, Eleazar. And Akiva, who had been his disciple, comes to him. Akiva says, let me tell him, for if an improper person was to tell him, it might be the ending of the world. So there's again this sort of feeling of miracles and divine power. I'm not quite sure what's going on. And he comes in and hints at it, and Eleazar correctly interprets the hints and tears his garments and, you know, sits down on the ground and so forth. And one version, at least, of the account is that at that point, a third of the barley in the world was burned up, and a third of the olives, and a third of something else. So somehow, there's a catastrophe. Now, I'm not sure. What may be really going on in the original is that the winning side destroy food that they think is impure and that Eleazar thought was pure. So that might be where that all came from. At least that's the standard Talmudic version. And we are then told that a while later, Rabbi Gamaliel, who was the head of the Sanhedrin, the sort of top-level Hillel member official, is in a ship. And a huge wave comes towards him as if to destroy the ship. And he says, I think this is on account of Eleazar ben Hyrcanus, who we have banned. And he stands up and he says to the heavens, I did not do this for my own glory or for the glory of my family, but that your people not be divided. Because what's going on is a suppression of the school of Shammai. I think that what's going on, that what's behind all of this story, is the final decision of the majority to say to the minority, you can preach all you like, but we will punish you if you actually try to judge according to your interpretation of the law instead of ours. And the wave subsides. But the final bit of the story is that Eleazar's wife is Gamaliel's sister. And she says after this, when he's banned now for the rest of his life, and she commands her husband not to fall on his face in petitionary prayer, not to ask God for things. And eventually, at some point when she's distracted, he does. And at that point, Gamaliel dies. So there's this very weird picture that from one standpoint, the story seems to be saying the decision to suppress Shammai was right, and from another, it looks as though it's somehow a catastrophe, or at least God's on Shammai's side, right? As soon as Eleazar complains to God about how he's been mistreated, boom, there goes the head of the Sanhedrin. But anyway, it's each sort of a story, a somewhat complicated and interesting story. But the basic point I'm making really is that it can be seen as a solution to this problem of how you get legal uniformity, how you determine the law, when you at least claim to believe that it's all coming out of divine inspiration. And if Eleazar has better arguments than you do, that's all right. We got more votes than he does. And that's, I think, the sort of bottom line of it. But there are a bunch of other things of this sort as well in Jewish law, which is lots of fun, that the... For example, the stoning of disobedient children. And if you read in Maimonides and some of the other things, what they basically do is to interpret implausibly the language of the bit of the Bible in such a way that it'll never apply. So that, for example, the relevant thing says that the father and the mother are to come to the elders of the village and tell them that their son has been disobedient and has given them lip, basically. And, well, they say to begin with, that certainly means they can't be cripples, because if they were cripples, they couldn't come to the elders. Even one of them was a cripple, they couldn't come. It says they come, right? Furthermore, since they're supposed to say it, that means they've got to speak with identical voices. And then Maimonides says, and I'm not sure if he's made this one up or not, he says, look, when the... If the son is less than 13, he's not an adult and he can't be punished. If the son is 13, he could sleep with a woman and get her pregnant. And by 3 months later, it could be known that she was pregnant. And once it's known she's pregnant, he's not a son anymore. He's a father now. And therefore, this rule could only apply to a boy between ages 13 and 13 and 3 months. I think I've got that one right, if I remember. So there's a bunch of stuff of this sort, where you have a rule, and you're not willing to say you don't believe in the rule, but you're also not willing to enforce it. And there are a fair number of other examples of different sorts. There's the business about canceling debts every 7 years. Eventually they construct a legal formula in which I think what you're doing is somehow handing the debt to the court to hold you for you through the seventh year and then it gives it back to you. It's called prosbul, and I'm not sure, not being a trained Jewish lawyer, whether I've got that right, but it's some such mechanism so that you in fact can make it through the seventh year. And you might be tempted to say, well, the reason they did this was it didn't occur to God in making the rule that nobody would lend any money on the sixth year, but as a matter of fact, it did occur to God, because if you read the text, it warns people, don't be selfish and refuse to lend when we're getting close to the year of cancellation. Help your neighbor and so forth. So, and finally, that's finally on this particular subject. One of the ways in which they both work around fixed points but also fill in blanks is to take the position that if there is no competent legal scholar to say what the religious law is, the communal authorities, sort of the equivalent of the city council within the Jewish community in some town or other, is entitled to make rules. And some of the argument is that in Israel, in addition to what was done by the Sanhedrin, there was also a king in Israel and he did things, so somehow the communal authorities have inherited his authority. And the rule more or less accepted, this is diaspora Judaism, when you've got a whole bunch of scattered communities. I should say one of the things that's sort of interesting is that it turns out that until the 18th century, most Jews were living under Jewish law, even though the Kingdom of Israel had been wiped out nearly 2,000 years before. And the reason is that the standard arrangement in both Europe and the Islamic world was that the local rulers subcontracted the job of ruling their Jewish subjects to the Jewish local authorities in exchange for an appropriate tax payment, and they're behaving themselves and so forth, which is also sort of interesting. But in any case, so one of the rules was a division essentially between religious law and mundane law. And mundane law is called mammon and religious law is called isur. And the interesting story here has to do with marriage. Because the religious law specifies very simple and easy conditions for getting married. And this is not entirely satisfactory if you are, let us say, the father of a 14 or 15-year-old girl who might be casting eyes at someone you think is an unsuitable son-in-law. I should say the age of majority for women, I think, is 12 and a half, if I remember correctly, in that legal system. And for boys, 13 and a half, roughly, something like that. And so there was apparently a good deal of pressure by the communal authorities to try to put additional requirements. There had to be witnesses or consent of the parents or... Well, consent of somebody, some additional requirements for marriage. And the trouble with that was that marriage was Isur. Marriage was religious law, not mundane law, and therefore it looked as though the biblical requirements trumped anything the communal authorities could do. And they came up with a number of solutions to this problem, of which my favorite solution goes as follows. That in order to have a valid marriage, the groom must give the bride a wedding ring or some other such token, which must belong to him. What belongs to whom, however, is a matter of mammon. That's material law, that's mundane law. So if you marry a girl without satisfying the requirements the communal authority has set, we will retroactively confiscate the wedding ring. And since the wedding ring wasn't yours, it wasn't a valid marriage, so you're not really married at all. And that didn't work very well. People did do it, but they were uncomfortable with it. And my impression from my reading is that part of the reason they're uncomfortable with it is that this is being decided, in effect, in each separate community. However, whether a woman is or is not married matters beyond your community, because she might move to another community and somebody might marry her. And if, in the view of the community she moved to, she's still married, so they don't accept this argument, then when she marries somebody else, their children are momsers, which means not merely bastards. It's a stronger term than our bastard. A momser is the child of a couple who could not legally be married, not just aren't. Well, one of the reasons you can't legally be married is already married to somebody else. Another is incest is another thing that gives that same result. So therefore, there was a real problem of having a decentralized system making decisions that were dubious in terms of religious law, and therefore that the next town over might not accept. So eventually they fell back on an alternative method, which really they're still using in a somewhat different context, and that was that since the husband can divorce the wife without cause, if you get married without meeting our requirements, we will seize you and compel you on threat of imprisonment or beating or something to divorce your wife. And the issue still remains, not in that particular context, but under Jewish law, strictly speaking, a woman can't get a divorce. I don't mean the law of Israel, which is not Jewish law, although it's influenced by Jewish law. I don't know what that is. Maybe marriage it is Jewish law, but in general it isn't. But a man can get a divorce. The way in which things changed about 1,000 years ago was that they adopted the position that a woman could go to a court, give reasons why her husband should be compelled to divorce her, and that then the court could use sanctions of various sorts to make him divorce her. But it was still a matter of the husband divorcing the wife, not the other way around. And the way in which this is still a problem is the situation of a woman whose husband has run off, or maybe is dead and she doesn't know it, and she can't remarry because you can't compel somebody to divorce her if he's not there. If you don't know if he's alive or not, you can't compel her to divorce her. And that, I gather, is there's some term in Hebrew, which I forget, for women who are in this situation. But I gather it's still among sort of Orthodox communities, still an issue. But it seems to be quite interesting. Let me mention the two other cases, though, of the same problem of working around fixed points. And one of them is in Islamic law, where you've got this rule that if somebody steals, you're supposed to cut off his hand. And certainly modern people defending Islamic law tend to be very uncomfortable with that. And my impression from looking at what I can tell about Sharia is that people were uncomfortable about it a long time ago, because there are all sorts of hedges to prevent this from happening. For example, it is not the Hod crime of theft. A Hod crime is a crime forbidden by the Quran. And it's not the Hod crime of theft to steal food when you're starving. All right. Furthermore, if you steal food, it will be presumed that it was because you were starving. And therefore, stealing food in general is not the Hod crime of theft. It is not the Hod crime of theft to steal something if you believed it was yours, even if you had no basis for that belief. And there are a set of other such conditions, which I gather, at least in some Islamic societies, probably not in all, meant that it was unlikely that somebody who actually committed theft would have his hand cut off, even though they couldn't cancel the law because it was considered... I don't remember if that's one that's actually in the Quran or if that's one of the ones that was done by the very early caliphs and was therefore sort of incorporated into the Hod offenses. And finally, of course, we have the case which has doubtless occurred to all of you already, namely the Second Amendment in the U.S. That in the U.S., lots and lots of cities for a long time have forbidden their citizens to own guns in various fashion. And very, very recently, the Supreme Court, having shifted its composition a bit, decided, well, actually, the Second Amendment does say something about that, doesn't it? But for a long time, what was happening was that local, state and local governments were, on various grounds, forbidding, violating the right to bear arms, which the Constitution explicitly has in the Second Amendment. So I would argue that that was another case where you have your fixed point. The consensus opinion, at least in many, not all places, is that it's wrong, and you therefore find one excuse or another to work your way around. All right, well, I've got several more things in my list, and the next time I run out of stuff to talk about, I'll probably talk about some of them, but this will do for the moment. Have a nice weekend.